4. He who would penetrate into the essence of language should begin by putting aside all the philologist's apparatus and observe how a hunter speaks to his dog. The dog follows the outstretched finger. He listens, tense, to the sound of the word, but shakes his head. This kind of man's speech he does not understand. Then he makes one or two sentences to indicate his idea. He stands still and barks, which in his language is a sentence containing the question, "Is that what master means?" Then, still in dog language, he expresses his pleasure at finding that he was right. In just the same way, two men who do not really possess a single word in common seek to understand one another. When a country parson explains something to a peasant woman, he looks at her keenly, and unconsciously he puts into his look the essence that she would certainly never be able to understand from a parsonic mode of expression. The locutions of today, without exception, are capable of comprehension only in association with other modes of speech. Adequate by themselves, they are not, and never have been. If the dog now wants something, he wags his tail. Impatient of master's stupidity in not understanding this perfectly distinct and expressive speech, he adds a vocal expression. He barks. And finally, an expression of attitude. He mimes or makes signs. Here the man is the obtuse one who has not yet learnt to talk. Finally, something very remarkable happens. When the dog has exhausted every other device to comprehend the various speeches of his master, he suddenly plants himself squarely, and his eye bores into the eye of the human. Something deeply mysterious is happening here, the immediate contact of ego and two. The look emancipates from the limitations of waking consciousness. Being understands itself without signs. Here the dog has become a judge of men, looking his opposite straight in the eye and grasping, behind the speech, the speaker. Languages of these kinds we habitually use without being conscious of the fact. The infant speaks long before it has learnt its first word, and the grown-up talks with it without even thinking of the ordinary meanings of the words he or she is using. That is, the sound forms, in this case, subserve a language that is quite other than that of words. Such languages also have their groups and dialects. They too can be learnt, mastered, and misunderstood. And they are so indispensable to us that verbal language would mutiny if we were to attempt to make it do all the work without assistance from tone and gesture language. Even our script, which is verbal language for the eye, would be almost incomprehensible but for the aid that it gets from gesture language in the form of punctuation. It is the fundamental mistake of linguistic science that it confuses language in general with human word language, and that not merely theoretically, but habitually in the practical conduct of all its investigations. As a result, it has remained immensely ignorant of the vast profusion of speech modes of different kinds that are in common use amongst beasts and men. The domain of speech, taken as a whole, is far wider, and verbal speech, with its incapacity to stand alone, an incapacity not wholly shaken off even now, has really a much more modest part in it than its students have observed. As to the origin of human speech, the very phrase implies a wrong enunciation of the problem. Verbal speech, for that is what is meant, never had origins at all in the sense here postulated. It is not primary, and it is not unitary. The vast importance to which it has attained since a certain stage in man's history must not deceive us as to its position in the history of free-moving entity. An investigation into speech certainly ought not to begin with man. But the idea of a beginning for animal language too is erroneous. Speaking is so closely bound up with the living being of the animal, in contradiction to the mere being of the plant, that not even unicellular creatures devoid of all sense organs can be conceived of as speechless. To be a microcosm in the macrocosm is one and the same thing as having a power to communicate oneself to another. To speak of a beginning of speech in animal history is meaningless, for that microcosmic existences are in plurality is a matter of simple self-evidence. To speculate on other possibilities is mere waste of time. Granted that Darwinian fancies about an original generation and first pairs of ancestors belong with the Victorian rearguard and should be left there, still the fact remains that swarms also are awake and aware, inwardly and livingly sensible, of a we, and reaching out to one another for linkages of waking consciousness. Waking being is activity in the extended, and further is willed activity. This is the distinction between the movements of a microcosm and the mechanical mobility of the plant, the animal, or the man in the plant state, i.e. asleep. Consider the animal activity of nutrition, procreation, defense, attack. One side of it regularly consists in getting into touch with the macrocosm by means of the senses, whether it be the undifferentiated sensitivity of the unicellular creature or the vision of a highly developed eye that is in question. Here there is a definite will to receive impression. This we call orientation. But besides, there exists from the beginning a will to produce impression in the other, what we call expression. And with that at once we have speaking as an activity of the animal waking consciousness. Since then, nothing fundamentally new has supervened. The world languages of high civilizations are nothing but exceedingly refined expositions of potentialities that were all implicitly contained in the fact of willed impressions of unicellular creatures upon one another. But the foundations of this fact lie in the primary feeling of fear. The waking consciousness makes a cleft in the cosmic, projects a space between particulars, and alienates them. To feel oneself alone is one's first impression in the daily awakening, and hence the primitive impulse to crowd together in the midst of this alien world, to assure oneself sensibly of the proximity of the other, to seek a conscious connection with him. The thou is deliverance from the fear of the being alone. The discovery of the thou, the sense of another self resolved organically and spiritually out of the world of the alien, is the grand moment in the early history of the animal. Thereupon, animals are. One has only to look long and carefully into the tiny world of a water droplet under the microscope to be convinced that the discovery of the thou, and with it that of the I, has been taking place here in its simplest imaginable form. These tiny creatures know not only the other, but also the others. They possess not merely waking consciousness, but also relations of waking consciousness, and therewith not only expression, but the elements of an expression speech. It is well to recall here the distinction between the two great speech groups. Expression speech treats the other as witness and aims purely at effects upon him, while communication speech regards him as a collocutor and expects him to answer. To understand means to receive impression with one's own feeling of their significance. And it is on this that the effect of the highest form of human expression speech, art, depends. Footnote. Art is fully developed in the animals. So far as man can get at it by way of analogy, it consists for them in rhythmic movement, dance, and sound formation, song. But this is by no means the limit of artistic impression on the animal itself. End of footnote. To come to an understanding, to hold a conversation, postulates that the other's feeling of significance is the same as one's own. The elementary unit of an expression speech before witnesses is called the motive. Command of the motive is the basis of all expression technique. On the other hand, the impression produced for the purpose of an understanding is called the sign and is the elementary unit of all communication technique, including, therefore, at the highest level, human speech. Of the extensiveness of both these speech worlds in the waking consciousness of man, we today can scarcely form an idea. Expression speech, which appears in the earliest times with all the religious seriousness of the taboo, includes not only weighty and strict ornament, which in the beginning coincides completely with the idea of art and makes every stiff, inert thing into a vehicle of the expression, but also the solemn ceremonial, whose web of formulae spreads over the whole of public life and even over that of the family, and the language of costume, which is contained in clothing, tattooing, and personal adornment, all of which have a uniform significance. Footnote. Jesus says to the 70 whom he is sending out on mission, "And salute no man on the way." Luke chapter 10, verse 4. The ceremonial of greeting on the high road is so complicated that people in a hurry have to omit it. End of footnote. The investigators of the 19th century vainly attempted to trace the origin of clothing to the feeling of shame or to utilitarian motives. It is in fact intelligible only as the means of an expression speech, and as such it is developed to a grandiose level in all the high civilizations, including our own of today. We need only think of the dominant part played by the mode in our whole public life and doings, the regulation attire for important occasions, the nuances of wear for this and that social function, the wedding dress, mourning, of the military uniform, the priest's robes, orders and decorations, mitre and tonsure, periwig and queue, powder, rings, styles of hairdressing. Of all the significant displays and concealments of person, the costume of the mandarin and the senator, the odalisk and the nun, of the court state of Nero, Saladin and Montezuma, not to mention the details of peasant costumes, the language of flowers, colours and precious stones. As for the language of religion, it is superfluous to mention it, for all this is religion. The communication languages, in which every kind of sense impression that it is possible to conceive more or less participates, have gradually evolved, so far as the peoples of the higher cultures are concerned, three outstanding signs: picture, sound, and gesture, which in the script speech of the Western civilization have crystallized into a unit of letter, word, and punctuation mark. In the course of this long evolution, there comes about at the last the detachment of speaking from speech. Of all processes in the history of language, none has a wider bearing than this. Originally, all motives and signs are unquestionably the product of the moment and meant only for a single individual act of the active waking consciousness. Their actual and their felt and willed significances are one and the same. But this is no longer so when a definite stock of signs offers itself for the living act of giving the sign. For with that, not only is the activity differentiated from its means, but the means are differentiated from their significance. The unity of the two not only ceases to be a matter of self-evidence, it ceases even to be a possibility. The feeling of significance is a living feeling, and like everything else belonging with time and destiny, it is uniquely occurring and non-recurring. No sign, however well known and habitually used, is ever repeated with exactly the same connotation. And hence it is that originally no sign ever recurred in the same form. The domain of the rigid sign is unconditionally one of the things become of the pure extended. It is not an organism, but a system which possesses its own causal logic and brings the irreconcilable opposition of space and time, intellect and mood, also into the waking connections of two beings. This fixed stock of signs and motifs, with its ostensibly fixed meanings, must be acquired by learning and practice if one wishes to belong to the community of waking consciousness with which it is associated. The necessary concomitant of speech divorced from speaking is the notion of the school. This is fully developed in the higher animals, and in every self-contained religion, every art, every society, it is presupposed as the background of the believer, the artist, the well-brought-up human being. And from this point, each community has its sharply defined frontier. To be a member, one must know its language, i.e., its articles of faith, its ethics, its rules. In Counterpoint and Catholicism alike, bliss is not to be compassed by mere feeling and goodwill. Culture means a hitherto unimagined intensification of the depth and strictness of the form language in every department. For each individual belonging to it, it consists, as his personal culture, religious, ethical, social, artistic, in a lifelong process of education and training for this life. And consequently, in all great arts, in the great churches, mysteries and orders, there is reached such a command of form as astonishes the human being himself, and ends by breaking itself under the stress of its own exigences. Whereupon, in every culture alike, there is set up, expressly or tacitly, the slogan of a return to nature. This maestria extends also to verbal language. Side by side with the social polish of the period of the Tyrannus or of the Troubadours, with the fugues of Bach and the vase paintings of Exequius, we have the art of Attic oratory and that of French conversation, both presupposing, like any other art, a strict and carefully matured convention and a long and exacting training of the individual. Metaphysically, the significance of this separating off of a set language can hardly be overestimated. The daily practice of intercourse in settled forms, and the command of the entire waking consciousness through such forms, of which there is no longer a sensed process of formation ad hoc, but which are just simply there and require understanding in the strictest sense of the word, lead to an ever sharper distinction between understanding and feeling within the waking consciousness. An incipient language is felt understandingly. The practice of speaking requires one first to feel the known speech medium, and secondly, to understand the intention put into it on this occasion. Consequently, the kernel of all schooling lies in the acquisition of elements of knowledge. Every church proclaims unhesitatingly that not feeling but knowledge leads into its ways of salvation. All true artistry rests on the sure knowledge of forms that the individual has not to discover but to learn. Understanding is knowledge conceived of as a being. It is that which is completely alien to blood, race, time. From the opposition of rigid speech to coursing blood and developing history come the negative ideals of the absolute, the eternal, the universally valid, the ideals of church and school. But just this, in the last analysis, makes languages incomplete and leads to the eternal contradiction between what is in fact spoken and what was willed or meant by the speaking. We might indeed say that lies came into the world with the separation of speech from speaking. The signs are fixed, but not so their meaning. From the outset we feel that this is so, then we know it, and finally we turn our knowledge to account. It is an old, old experience that when one wills to say something, the words fail one. Versagen, missay, that one does not express oneself aright, and in fact says something other than what was meant, that one may speak accurately and be understood inaccurately. And so finally we get to the art, which is widespread even amongst animals, for example cats, of using words to conceal thoughts. One says not everything. One says something quite different. One speaks formally about nothing. One talks briskly to cover the fact that one has said something. Or one imitates the speech of another. The red-backed shrike, Lanius colurio, imitates the strophes of small songbirds in order to lure them. This is a well-known hunter's dodge, but here again, established motives and signs are precedent for it, just as much as they are a condition for the faking in antiques or the forgery of a signature. And all these traits, met with in attitude and mien, as in handwriting and verbal utterance, reappear in the language of every religion, every art, every society. We need only refer to the ideas expressed by the words hypocrite, orthodox, heretic, the English cant, the secondary senses of diplomat, Jesuit, actor, the masks and warinesses of polite society, and the painting of today, in which nothing is honest more, and which in every gallery offers the eye untruth in every imaginable form. In a language that one stammers, one cannot be a diplomat. But in the real command of a language, there is the danger that the relation between the means and the meaning may be made into a new means. There arises an intellectual art of playing with expression, practiced by the Alexandrines and the Romantics, by Theocritus and Brentano in lyric poetry, by Reger in music, by Kierkegaard in religion. Finally, speech and truth exclude one another. Footnote. All forms, even those that are most felt, contain an element of untruth. Goethe. In systematic philosophy, the intent of the thinker coincides neither with the written words nor with the understanding of his readers, as it consists in his thinking meanings into words in the course of using the words themselves.
Da es ein Denken in Wortbedeutungen ist, im Verlauf der Darstellung mit sich selbst.
End of footnote. And in fact, this is just what brings up, in the age of fixed language, the typical judge of men, who is all race and knows how to take the being that is speaking. To look a man keenly in the eyes, to size up the speaker behind the stump speech or the philosophical discourse, to know behind the prayer the heart, and behind the common good tone the more intimate levels of social importance, and that instantaneously, immediately, and with the self-evident certainty that characterizes everything cosmic. That is what is lacking to the real taboo man, for whom one language at any rate carries conviction. A priest who is also a diplomat cannot be genuinely a priest. An ethical philosopher of the Kant stamp is never a judge of men. The man who lies in his verbal utterances betrays himself, without observing it, in his demeanour. One who uses demeanour to dissimulate with betrays himself in his tone. It is precisely because rigid speech separates means and intent that it never carries it off with the keen appraiser. The adept reads between the lines and understands a man as soon as he sees his walk or his handwriting. The deeper and more intimate a spiritual communion, the more readily it dispenses with signs and linkages through waking consciousness. A real comradeship makes itself understood with few words. A real faith is silent altogether. The purest symbol of an understanding that has again got beyond language is the old peasant couple sitting in the evening in front of their cottage and entertaining one another without a word's being passed, each knowing what the other is thinking and feeling. Words would only disturb the harmony. From such a state of reciprocal understanding, something or other reaches back, far beyond the collective existence of the higher animal world, deep in the primeval history of free-moving life. Here, deliverance from the waking consciousness is, at moments, very nearly achieved. 5. Of all the signs that have come to be fixed, none has led to greater consequences than that which in its present state we call word. It belongs, no doubt, to the purely human history of speech, but nevertheless the idea, or at any rate the conventional idea, of an origin of verbal language is as meaningless and barren as that of a zero point for speech generally. A precise beginning is inconceivable for the latter, because it is compresent with and contained in the essence of the microcosm, and for the former, because it presupposes many fully developed kinds of communication speech and constitutes only one element, though in the end the dominant element, of a slow and quiet evolution. It is a fundamental error in all theories, however diametrically opposed to each other, like those of Wundt and of Jespersen, that they investigate speaking in words as if they were something new and self-contained, which inevitably leads them into a radically false psychology. In reality, verbal language is a very late phenomenon, not a young shoot, but the last blossom borne by one of the ramifications of the parent stem of all vocal speeches. Footnote. Jespersen deduces language from poesy, dance, and particularly courtship. Progress in Language, 1894. End of footnote. In actuality, a pure word speech does not exist. No one speaks without employing, in addition to the set vocabulary, quite other modes of speech, such as emphasis, rhythm, and facial play, which are much more primary than the language of the word, and with which, moreover, it has become completely intertwined. It is highly necessary, therefore, to avoid regarding the ensemble of present-day word languages, with its extreme structural intricacy, as an inner unity with a homogeneous history. Every word language known to us has very different sides, and each of these sides has its own destiny within the history of the whole. There is not one sense perception that would be wholly irrelevant to an adequate history of the use of words. Further, we must distinguish very strictly between vocal and verbal languages. The former is familiar even to the simpler genera of animals. The latter is in certain characters, individual characters, it is true, but all the more significant for that, a radically different thing. For every animal voice language, further, expression motives, a roar of anger, and communication signs, a cry of warning, can be clearly distinguished, and doubtless the same may be said of the earliest words. But was it then as an expression or as a communication language that verbal language arose? Was it in quite primitive conditions, independent, more or less, of any and every visual language such as picture and gesture? To such questions we have no answer, since we have no inkling of what the preforms of the word, properly so called, were. Naive indeed is the philology which uses what we of today call primitive languages, in reality incomplete pictures of very late language conditions, as premises for the conclusions as to the origin of words and the word. The word is in them an already established, highly developed and self-evident means, i.e. precisely what anything originally is not. There can be no doubt that the sign which made it possible for the future word language to detach itself from the general vocal speech of the animal world was that which I call name, a vocal image serving to denote a something in the world around, which was felt as a being and by the act of naming became a noumen. It is unnecessary to speculate as to how the first names came to be. No human speech accessible to us at this time of day gives us the least point d'appui here. But contrary to the view of modern research, I consider that the decisive turn came not from a change of the throat formation, or from a peculiarity of sound formation, or from any other physiological factor. If any such changes ever took place at all, it would be the race side that they would affect. Not even an increased capacity for self-expression by existing means, like, say, the transition from word to sentence, H. Paul, but a profound spiritual change. Footnote. Sentence-like complexes of sound are known also to the dog. When the Australian dingo reverted from domestication to the wild state, he reverted also from the house dog's bark to the wolf's howl, a phenomenon that indicates a transition to very much simpler sound signs, but has nothing to do with words. End of footnote. With the name comes a new world outlook, and if speech in general is the child of fear, of the unfathomable terror that wells up when the waking consciousness is presented with the facts, that impels all creatures together in the longing to prove each other's reality and proximity, then the first word, the name, is a mighty leap upward. The name grazes the meaning of consciousness and the source of fear alike. The world is not merely existent, a secret is felt in it. Above and apart from the more ordinary objects of expression and communication language, man names that which is enigmatic. It is the beast that knows no enigmas. Man cannot think too solemnly, reverently, of this first name-giving. It was not well always to speak the name. It should be kept secret. A dangerous power dwelt in it. With the name, the step is taken from the everyday physical of the beast to the metaphysical of man. It was the greatest turning point in the history of the human soul. Our epistemology is accustomed to set speech and thought side by side, and it is quite right if we take into consideration only the languages that are still accessible at the present day. But I believe that we can go much deeper than this, and say that with the name, religion in the proper sense, definite religion in the midst of formless quasi-religious awe, came into being. Religion in this sense means religious thought. It is the new conception of the creative understanding emancipated from sensation. We say, in a very significant idiom, that we reflect on, think over something. With the understanding of things named, the formation of a higher world, above all sensational existence, is begun. Higher, both according to obvious symbolism, and in reference to the position of the head which man guesses, often with painful distinctness, to be the home of his thoughts. It gives to the primary feeling of fear both an object and a glimpse of liberation. On this religious first thought, all the philosophical, scholarly, scientific thought of later times has been and remains dependent for its very deepest foundations. These first names we have to think of as quite separate and individual elements in the stock of signs of a highly developed sound and gesture language, the richness of which we can no longer imagine, since these other means have come to be subordinate to the word languages, and their further developments have been in dependent connection therewith. Footnote. The gesture languages of today, without exception, presuppose word language, and are completely dependent upon its intellectual systematism. Examples: the mimicry of the actor, and the language which the American Indians have formed for themselves for the purpose of mutually understanding one another in spite of extreme differences and fluidity in the verbal languages of the various tribes. Wundt quotes the following to show how complicated sentences can be handled in this language. White soldiers, led by an officer of high rank but little intelligence, took the Mescalero Indians prisoners. End of footnote. One thing, however, was assured when the name inaugurated the transformation and spiritualization of communication technique: the preeminence of the eye over the other sense organs. Man's awakeness and awareness was in an illuminated space. His depth experience was a radiation outward towards light sources and light resistances, and he conceived of his ego as a middle point in the light. Visible or invisible was the alternative which governed the state of understanding in which the first names arose. Were the first noumena, perhaps, things of the light world that were felt, heard, observed in their effects, but not seen? No doubt the group of names, like everything else that marks a turning point in the course of world happenings, must have developed both rapidly and powerfully. The entire light world, in which everything possesses the properties of position and duration in space, was, in the midst of what tensions of cause and effect, thing and property, object and subject, very soon listed with innumerable names, and so anchored in the memory. For what we now call memory is the capacity of storing for the understanding by means of the name, the named. Over the realm of understood visuals, Seidinger, supervenes a more intellectual realm of namings, which shares with it the logical property of being purely extensive, disposed in polarity, and ruled by the causal principle. All word types, like cases and pronouns and prepositions, which arise, of course, much later, have a causal or local meaning in respect of named units. Adjectives and verbs also have frequently come into existence in pairs of opposites. Often, as in the Iwe languages of West Africa, investigated by Westerman, the same word is pronounced low or high to denote, for example, great and small, far and near, passive and active. Later, these relics of gesture language pass completely into the word form, as we see clearly, for example, in the Greek makros and mikros and the u sounds of Egyptian designations of suffering. It is the form of thinking in opposites which, starting from these antithetical word pairs, constitutes the foundation of all inorganic logic, and turns every scientific discovery of truths into a movement of conceptual contraries, of which the most universal instance is that of an old view and a new one being contrasted as error and truth. The second great turning point was the use of grammar. Besides the name, there was now the sentence. Besides the verbal designation, the verbal relation. And thereupon reflection, which is a thinking in word relations that follows from the perception of things for which word labels exist, became the decisive characteristic of man's waking consciousness. The question whether the communication languages already contained effective sentences before the appearance of the genuine name is a difficult one. The sentence, in the present acceptation of the word, has indeed developed within these languages according to its own conditions and with its own phases, but nevertheless it postulates the prior existence of the name. Sentences as conceptual relations become possible only with the intellectual change that accompanied their birth. And we must assume further that within the highly developed wordless languages, one character or trait after another, in the course of continuous practical use, was transformed into verbal form, and as such fell into its place in an increasingly solid structure, the prime form of our present-day languages. Thus the inner build of all verbal languages rests upon foundations of far older construction, and for its further development is not dependent upon the stock of words and its destiny. It is, in fact, just the reverse, for with syntax the original group of individual names was transformed into a system of words, whose character was given not by their proper but by their grammatical significance. The name made its appearance as something novel and entirely self-contained. But word species arose as elements of the sentence, and thereafter the contents of waking consciousness streamed in overflowing profusion into this world of words, demanding to be labelled and represented in it, until finally even all became, in one shape or another, a word and available for the thought process. Thenceforward, the sentence is the decisive element. We speak in sentences and not words. Attempts to define the two have been frequent, but never successful. According to F.N. Fink, word formation is an analytical and sentence formation a synthetical activity of the mind, the first preceding the second. It is demonstrable that the same actuality received as impression is variously understood, and words, therefore, are definable from very different points of view. But according to the usual definition, a sentence is the verbal expression of a thought, a symbol, says H. Paul, for the connection of several ideas in the soul of the speaker. It seems to me quite impossible to settle the nature of the sentence from its contents. The fact is simply that we call the relatively largest mechanical units employed sentences, and the relatively smallest words. Over this range extends the validity of grammatical laws. But as soon as we pass from theory to practice, we see that language as currently used is no longer such a mechanism. It obeys not laws, but pulse. Thus, a race character is involved, a priori, in the way in which the matter to be communicated is set in sentences. Sentences are not the same for Tacitus and Napoleon as for Cicero and Nietzsche. The Englishman orders his material syntactically in a different way from the German. Not the ideas and thoughts, but the thinking, the kind of life, the blood, determine in the primitive, classical, Chinese and Western speech communities the type of the sentence unit, and with it the mechanical relation of the word to the sentence. The boundary between grammar and syntax should be placed at the point where the mechanical of speech ceases and the organic of speaking begins. Usages, custom, the physiognomy of the way that a man employs to express himself. The other boundary lies where the mechanical structure of the word passes into the organic factors of sound formation and expression. Even the children of immigrants can often be recognized by the way in which the English th is pronounced, a race trait of the land. Only that which lies between these limits is the language, properly so called, which has system, is a technical instrument, and can be invented, improved, changed, and worn out. Enunciation and expression, on the contrary, adhere to the race. We recognize a person known to us without seeing him by his pronunciation, and not only that, but we can recognize a member of an alien race even if he speaks perfectly correct German. The great sound modifications, like the old High German in Carolingian times and the Middle High German in the late Gothic, have territorial frontiers and affect only the speaking of the language, not the inner form of sentence and word. Words, I have just said, are the relatively smallest mechanical units in the sentence. There is probably nothing that is so characteristic of the thinking of a human species as the way in which these units are acquired by it. For the Bantu Negro, a thing that he sees belongs first of all to a very large number of categories of comprehension. Correspondingly, the word for it consists of a kernel or root and a number of monosyllabic prefixes. When he speaks of a woman in a field, his word is something like this: living, one, big, old, female, outside, human. This makes 7 syllables, but it denotes a single, clear-headed, and to us quite alien act of comprehension. There are languages in which the word is almost coextensive with the sentence. The gradual replacement of bodily or sonic by grammatical gestures is thus the decisive factor in the formation of sentences. But it has never been completed. There are no purely verbal languages. The activity of speaking in words, as it emerges more and more precise, consists in this, that through word sounds we awaken significance feelings, which in turn, through the sound of the word connections, evoke further relation feelings. Our schooling in speech trains us to understand in this abbreviated and indicative form not only light things and light relations, but also thought things and thought relations. Words are only named, not used definitively, and the hearer has to feel what the speaker means. This and this alone amounts to speech, and hence mien and tone play a much greater part than is generally admitted in the understanding of modern speech. Substantive signs may conceivably exist for many of the animals even, but verb signs never. The last grand event in this history, which brings the formation of verbal speech more or less to a close, is the coming of the verb. This assumes at the outset a very high order of abstraction. For substantives are words whereby things sense-defined in illuminated space become evocable also in afterthought. Even calling something invisible is a definition of it under the light aspect, while verbs describe types of change which are not seen but are extracted from the unendingly protean light world by noting the special characters of the individual cases and generating concepts from them. Falling stone is originally a unit impression, but we first separate movement and thing moved, and then isolate falling as one kind of movement from innumerable other sorts and shades thereof. Sinking, tottering, stumbling, slipping. We do not see the distinction, we know it. The difference between fleeing and running, or between flying and being wafted, altogether transcends the visual impression they produce, and is only apprehensible by a word-trained consciousness. But now, with this verb thinking, even life itself has become accessible to reflection. Out of the living impress made on the waking consciousness, out of the ambience of the becoming, which gesture speech, being merely imitative, leaves unquestioned and unprobed, that which is life itself, namely singularity of occurrence, is unconsciously eliminated, and the rest, as effect of a cause, the wind wafts, lightning flashes, the peasant ploughs, is put, under purely extensive descriptions, into suitable places in the sign system. One has to bury oneself completely in the solid definiteness of subject and predicate, active and passive, present and perfect, to perceive how entirely the understanding here masters the senses and unsouls actuality. In substantives, one can still regard the mental thing, the idea, as a copy of the visual thing. But in the verb, something inorganic has been put in place of something organic. The fact that we live, namely that we at this instant perceive something, becomes eventually a property of the something perceived. In terms of word thought, the perceived endures, is. Thus, finally, are formed the categories of thought, graded according to what is and what is not natural to it. Thus, time appears as a dimension, destiny as a cause, the living as chemical or psychical mechanism. It is in this wise that the style of mathematical, judicial, and dogmatic thought arises. And in this wise, too, arises that disunity which seems to us inseparable from the essence of man, but is really only the expression of the dominance of word language in his waking consciousness. This instrument of communication between ego and two has, by reason of its perfection, fashioned out of the animal understanding of sensation a thinking in words which stands proxy for sensation. Subtle thinking, splitting hairs, as it is called, is conversing with oneself in word significances. It is the activity that no kind of language but the language of words can subserve. and it becomes, with the perfection of the language, distinctive of the life habit of whole classes of human beings. The divorce of speech, rigid and devitalized, from speaking, which makes it impossible to include the whole truth in a verbal utterance, has particularly far-reaching consequences in the sign system of words. Abstract thinking consists in the use of a finite word framework into which it is sought to squeeze the whole infinite content of life. Concepts kill being and falsify waking being. Long ago, in the springtime of language history, while understanding had still to struggle in order to hold its own with sensation, this mechanization was without importance for life. But now, from a being who occasionally thought, man has become a thinking being, and it is the ideal of every thought system to subject life, once and for all, to the domination of intellect. This is achieved in theory by according validity only to the known, and branding the actual as a sham and a delusion. It is achieved in practice by forcing the voices of the blood to be silent in the presence of universal ethical principles. Footnote. Only technics are entirely true, for here the words are merely the key to actuality, and the sentences are continually modified until they are not truth, but actuality. A hypothesis claims not rightness, but usefulness. End of footnote. Both logic and ethics alike are systems of absolute and eternal truths for the intellect, and correspondingly untruths for history. However completely the inner eye may triumph over the outer in the domain of thought, in the realm of facts, the belief in eternal truths is a petty and absurd stage play that exists only in the heads of individuals. A true system of thoughts emphatically cannot exist, for no sign can replace actuality. Profound and honest thinkers are always brought to the conclusion that all cognition is conditioned a priori by its own form, and can never reach that which the words mean, apart again from the case of technics, in which the concepts are instruments and not aims in themselves. And this ignorabimus is in conformity also with the intuition of every true sage, that abstract principles of life are acceptable only as figures of speech, trite maxims of daily use, underneath which life flows as it has always flowed onward. Race, in the end, is stronger than languages. And thus it is that under all the great names, it has been thinkers, who are personalities, and not systems, which are mutable, that have taken effect upon life.